end of our theory, so far we have mainly discussed different aspects of chemical shift. And more specifically, we've talked about how the influence of a neighboring atom can cause a change in chemical shift. Specifically, if we had some kind of highly electronegative substituent that was located next to a nucleus we were observing, then that electronegative substituent is going to pull electron density away from that nucleus being observed. Because of that decrease in the electron density surrounding it, that nucleus is going to be more exposed to the machine's magnetic field. And if it's more exposed to that magnetic field, that means there's going to be a larger energy gap that that nucleus is going to experience. With a larger energy gap, that means you need a photon of higher energy in order to cross that gap. Photons of higher energy correspond to light of higher frequency. And since chemical shift is a machine-independent quantity that is directly derived from frequency, that means you're going to have an increase in the chemical shift. So electron-withdrawing groups that cause deshielding will cause a nucleus to have a higher energy gap, which corresponds to higher energy per photon, higher frequency of radiation, and higher chemical shift. That sequence of thoughts, you do need to be comfortable progressing through. So if you have not yet begun reviewing NMR, because NMR is going to be the primary topic on your lab quiz, there will, of course, be a discussion of the other labs that have happened since the last quiz, but since you haven't had any questions about NMR yet, I'm just alerting you ahead of time that NMR is going to be the primary topic of the lab quiz. And so do make sure you can go through that sequence of steps to talk about how deshielding leads to higher chemical shift. But chemical shift is only one piece of information that we get from NMR spectra. There are two other really important pieces of information, one of which that you've already dealt with indirectly if you've done the scan of the reference compound already, and one of which you've seen but we haven't really discussed. So the first of those effects, or first of those pieces of information, is integration. So some of you have done integration, but we need to formally discuss what integration is and how we can use it to determine the aspect of compound structure. And then even more importantly, we need to talk about splitting, which is a phenomenon that occurs between protons that are chemically inequivalent to each other. So let's address integration first, because that's by far the simpler topic. So integration is useful in proton NMR, because in proton NMR, there is nearly a linear relationship between the strength of a signal generated during the NMR experiment and the number of hydrogens that are present. Now, where the integrals show up is in something like this, just to create a mythical spectrum here. Here are two groups of peaks. In our discussion of splitting, we'll address why do we have a group of four somewhat symmetric peaks and another separate group of three. The integrals, the way that our machine does them, it displays them above a different peak. Different machines might have different ways of presenting that information, but the reason why it does it in this way, where it draws what's called a trace, is because the computer is simply adding the area underneath these curves as it scans across the spectrum from left to right. So those of you who have done it would be, you might have an easier time understanding this part, although we all did watch me go through it the other day, that when you first start to integrate, you'll see a trace that goes from the extreme left to the extreme right of the spectrum, and it's, again, adding up all the areas under those different curves. I'm mentioning this just to give a little bit of a backstory about older way in which NMR was acquired. Because I had mentioned at some point about the fact that in older machines it was not possible to do Fourier transform NMR, where you might do one frequency of observation at a time, or you might change the magnetic strength and scan at one frequency. Well, the results from those scans had to be plotted in some way. And of course, back 40 years ago, there weren't inkjet printers like we have today. So instead, they have what are called strip charts. Has anybody ever seen a device with a strip chart on it? Unlikely. Just like in a few years from now, if I try to talk to students about these 12-inch size discs that are made of black plastic that we used to scratch needles across of, you'll also look at me similarly. Talk about vinyl albums. But again, even this generation, some of you may not have ever seen one, but that's the point. These strip recorders, older technology that you're still going to encounter sometimes on old pieces of equipment. Because what they would do is they would have, for example, a constant change in, for example, observation frequency. That change would be coupled to the track of a piece of paper coming off of this strip recorder. And there would be a plotter pen, literally a little pen, that would move back and forth across an arm as that paper is continually pulled out. Again, though, that paper would progress at a constant pace in the same way that the frequency that you might be observing at would change in a constant pace. So as the frequency would change, the signal is generated, that plotter would respond, and eventually by the end of the experiment, you would have a plot that's been generated. Now, why am I mentioning this? Well, because integration, that's the area underneath the curve. Well, what if this is, again, 40 years ago, where not every lab necessarily had a computer available to do that integration? So what would be done is you'd take that plotter paper and you'd cut out the individual peaks. Because if the density of the paper was roughly a constant, then that means there was a linear relationship between the area of those peaks and the mass of them. So if you had to try to determine the integrations, you would cut out those pieces of paper, weigh them, and use the masses to figure out the relative ratios of the areas. Because we don't have to do that anymore. We do have this computer technique. But there's still one gotcha even with the computerized technique, which is something we can see in the following pair of examples. But did you have a question? Because if the paper was of a constant thickness, and let's say the paper was a constant density, then there would be a linear relationship between mass and surface area. So if you took the mass of the different peaks, you indirectly got at least a ratio of the different surface areas. But it's exactly that idea of ratio that comes up in this example, even with the assistance of a computer. I'm drawing up two different kinds of cyclic ethers. The second of one of which is often called a crown ether. If you use your imagination and imagine that the oxygens are like the tops of the spikes of a fancy crown. The reason it's called a crown ether is those oxygens are able to circle and encompass different kinds of ions. And exactly which ions they prefer to bind with depends on how large the molecule is, whether it's oxygen versus nitrogen at those different positions in the interior of the ring. But they're extraordinarily useful because it lets you take ions, complex them with this organic molecule, and then have those ions therefore be dissolved in organic solvents, even though they're ions. So just a little bit of a side story. We'll actually come back to discussing crown ethers next quarter, because ethers is a functional group we tackle next quarter. But if we were to ignore considerations of stereochemistry, totally ignore stereochemistry, how many unique hydrogens do we have on the left-hand compound, 1,4-dioxane?
ignoring stereochemistry.
Another way to ask that is if I radically halogenated that molecule and talked about all the possible monohalogenated products, and again ignored stereoisomers, how many unique products would I get from monohalogenation? Well, the answer is one, because the molecule is entirely symmetric. Each carbon is chemically equivalent to the other than any discussion about diastereotopicism or enantiotopicism. If we look at the second example, it's actually exactly the same situation. It's entirely symmetric, and each one of those hydrogens, ignoring stereochemistry, is equivalent to the other. So if we were to take a scan of each of these compounds, they would, in fact, each generate just one signal. And in fact, I would guess that these are close enough structurally to each other that that signal very likely would show up at, if not the same, then an awfully close chemical shift for both of those compounds. Now, what about... Please go ahead. Now, what about integration, though? Well, what would the computer call either of these integrations? It wouldn't, because although the intensity of the signal is linearly related to the number of hydrogens, let's say that we prepared two different samples with two different concentrations of these two different materials. And what if each compound had a slightly different sensitivity to the NMR spectrometer itself? In other words, it could look at the first compound and say, well, that's integration of one, because it has no other point of reference. It could look at the other compound and say, well, that's also an integration of one, because it has no other reference. So when we do integration, whether it's for our actual compounds we want to analyze or for this reference standard we're currently working on, you are having to tell the computer the number of hydrogens that do correspond to a signal, because again, although the signal strength is proportional, the computer doesn't know without measurement what that proportionality constant is. Now, there are ways to determine that, and I'll mention it in a moment, but let me write down this statement about integration. Both of the ethers shown above would generate nearly identical proton NMR spectra. Since ignoring stereochemistry, each compound contains only one type of hydrogen. And again, although the number of hydrogens is linear proportional to signal strength, that proportionality constant can only be determined by measurement. Without measurement, without that constant, the machine would be unable to distinguish between the two compounds. the types of problems that you're going to end up with in this class, you'll always be provided integral information. So we'll never encounter this situation of, do we really know what the integration is? But you just need to be aware that this is a real life consideration. Questions about integration? Yeah. My guess is that although there's more oxygens, there's the same number of oxygens per carbon, and you have the same repeating structural unit. So maybe across the molecule, there might be some through space interaction, but ignoring that, it should essentially have, therefore, about the same chemical shift. Again, because the oxygens and carbons, as you go around, have about the same type of proximity to each other. It would only be if you had some cross-molecular interaction, which is not impossible. So really, there would be almost no way to distinguish the two. Except, and that's the part I didn't write down here, unless we did a quantitative analysis. Because we, this section, we've already had a discussion about NMR solvents. You might remember that for NMR solvents, we often use not completely deuterated solvents, but mostly deuterated solvents, so that that little bit of residual solvent that has hydrogens could be used as a calibration. And again, in NMR solvents, often you'll add TMS, again, to have a calibration. Well, what if you prepared an NMR sample where that TMS's concentration was known, let's say, to 4 decimal places? Well, then when you put that sample into the NMR spectrometer and acquire the signal with TMS in it, you could get that signal strength, and with the structure of TMS having 12 hydrogens per molecule and knowing the concentration of TMS, you can figure out exactly the number of moles of hydrogen that are in that solution and how that corresponds then to the signal strength that's generated. If at the same time, in that same solution, you also have a compound that you want to analyze that you know its exact concentration, then you could take that same ratio and figure out, all right, if TMS had this response and it generated a signal this strong and it corresponds to 12 hydrogens at this concentration, then using the concentration of your compound and its signal strength, you can figure out how many hydrogens are on it. So that's a quantitative NMR experiment, which we'll never do in here. But it is one way that you could resolve the difference between these two compounds. But that does require knowing the concentration of the compounds. Other questions about integration? Then let's get into the stickier topic of splitting, as in splitting headache. Now, as far as why does splitting occur, that is something that's usually not discussed in first year OChem texts. And in fact, I don't even remember learning exactly how this occurs when I was in grad school. Now, I'm curious about this topic myself, and so I'm going to attempt, before the quarter's up, to read up on it. But all that we will be concerned about, because all that your textbook really addresses, is the results of splitting. And so we'll just take this following statement as fact for the moment, and if we get the chance, even if not this quarter, next quarter, when we get the chance to, we can come back to why does this effect happen. But here's the statement I will start off making. That hydrogens that are chemically inequivalent to each other can affect each other's magnetic fields. Hydrogens that are equivalent to each other all have the same magnetic environment, and so they don't interfere with each other's magnetic fields.
So let me just read this whole statement out. Hydrogens that are chemically inequivalent to each other can perturb each other's magnetic fields. Hydrogens that are chemically equivalent are part of the same magnetic environment, so one equivalent proton will not perturb the magnetic field of another. Now, what exactly is this interaction that occurs? Well, let me create an example molecule so we can discuss a very concrete case. And actually, to simplify all the arguments that I'm going to make today, I'm going to start with this disclaimer statement. In all the examples shown, we will ignore the effects of stereochemistry. So, the first example molecule is going to be the following. 1,1-dibromo, 2,2-dichloroethane. The molecule only has two hydrogens on it. And those two hydrogens will definitely be chemically inequivalent to each other. Because I have one hydrogen that's on a carbon that has two chlorines, one hydrogen that's on a carbon that has two bromines. If we wanted to predict what we know so far about NMR theory, what the spectrum of this compound might look like, we could guess the following, that statement I've made in the past, each unique type of hydrogen generates its own NMR signal, so we should see two peaks in the spectrum. The hydrogen A versus hydrogen B, which of these should be more downfield? Which of these would be more to the left of the spectrum? HA or HB? HA? Why? It's what, I'm sorry? That's right. Chlorine's more electronegative than bromine, so there's going to be more electron withdrawing that occurs around position A, and so it's going to have the higher chemical shift. And so our guess, not knowing anything about splitting, might be the spectrum would look like this. But one proton does affect the other. What will be seen in the spectrum is this. That each peak is instead present as a pair of peaks. Now I've drawn all those peaks being equal height. It is possible that in a real-life spectrum, one pair might be higher than the other in terms of height. But because both of those positions contain exactly one hydrogen, the area of the curves should end up being the same. Now, why is it that we have this doubling effect? Well, imagine the following. Let's say I'm proton A, and I'm being observed. So I'm interacting with proton B next door. Proton B has a different magnetic environment than me, proton A. Proton B might have its spin aligned with the external magnetic field, the one that the entire machine is under. If so, then from my perspective, A's perspective, that neighboring spin effectively adds to the overall magnetic field. Well, if it adds to the overall magnetic field, that's going to cause a wider energy gap, which again will cause the chemical shift to shift to the right. But another possibility is proton B, my neighbor, instead has a spin that's down. And if it's down, located or oriented opposite of the main magnetic field, then that's going to decrease the magnetic field strength. If you decrease the magnetic field strength, that means that the chemical shift is going to end up shifting to the right. Well, statistically, both possibilities occur. As the sample is being irradiated, the spins are going back and forth, and effectively, they're at roughly equal chance as far as what kind of interaction you'd have of a neighbor with a hydrogen being scanned. So, throughout the whole solution, half of those spins will be located up, and so half of the signal will be shifted to the left, and the other half, the spins will be located down, and so the peak will shift to the right. Both occur equally, and so one signal ends up splitting into two. That is the splitting effect. Now let me write out this example I just gave. Again, we're going to be talking about the effect of B on A. I could easily talk about the effect of A on B. The exact same thing's going to happen. But just so I don't tell the whole story twice, I'm going to focus just on B interacting with A. So A neighbor a neighboring proton, in this case B, that is non-equivalent to a proton being observed, which is again going to be A, can effectively add to or subtract from the magnetic field as experienced by A. The neighbor can therefore cause an increase or decrease in the chemical shift for proton A. Statistically, both possibilities occur equally, and so the signal for proton A appears to split. When we have this phenomenon where one neighbor causes another hydrogen to have its signal split into two, that's called a doublet. And there's a graphical way in which the split can be represented, which is if we imagine that we start out with the signal for A, and we first imagine that that signal starts out as just a single signal, if we say that there's no interaction with neighbors. We can then consider that this whole thing is going on in the machine, and we can assign the direction of the machine's magnetic field. If we say that neighbor B is, again, aligned with the magnetic field,
then it adds to that magnetic field as experienced by A. And so if we're looking at chemical shift, it's going to cause that chemical shift to move to the right. And so what I'm showing is the result of having that neighbor spin up. But the other possibility is that it is spin down. And that will have a subtractive effect on the magnetic field to the same degree that it would have been additive had it been flipped the other direction. So this is what results in one peak splitting into two. Now, depending on exactly which hydrogens of the compound are involved, that will determine how much of a split occurs. And the degree to which that split occurs is expressed by a quantity called J, known as the coupling constant. How much interaction is there between the two different types of hydrogens? Next quarter, we'll use coupling constants to try to identify in an alkene which pairs of protons might have a cis relationship to each other, a trans relationship, or a geminal relationship. Geminal meaning the two hydrogens involved would be on exactly the same carbon. So this is the case, again, of having just one inequivalent neighbor. We're going to next do a case of two inequivalent neighbors, but since it's going to use exactly the same logic, let me ask if there's questions about this first case first. All right, let's see the second case then. Second case, very similar. We'll still have one hydrogen, which I'll still label HA, that will be on a position that has two chlorines near it. But now I'll only put one bromine on the other carbon. Which means that carbon will have two hydrogens that, if we ignore stereochemistry, are chemically equivalent to each other. And actually, if we think about it, where position A is, that is not a stereocenter. So at most, these protons would be enantiotopic, not diastereotopic. As such, if all I do is say that all of this is being discussed in an achiral solvent, they would still be chemically equivalent to each other. But just to simplify, that's why I made that catch-all statement at the beginning, that we're going to ignore stereochemistry in our discussions. So each of these HB protons could have their own spins independently being oriented up versus down relative to the external magnetic field. Well, since each spin is independent of the other, that means we really have four unique spin combinations where both spins are up, where the first spin is down, the second is up, an equivalent energy case, but still a distinct case where the first proton is up and the second is down, and then the last case where you have both of the spins pointed down. I say that these are two equivalent cases, one up down versus one down up, because since the spins are independent of each other, both of those possibilities are distinct statistically. I say they're equal energy cases because if you have one spin up and one spin down, those two would effectively cancel each other's effect. So whatever peak would result would be in exactly the same place that the original peak would have been in. But because you have two unique versions of that same result, the peak will be double the height in comparison to the other peaks that show up. Let me show you this graphically so you can see what I'm talking about. So, and I'll do this in two different ways. Let's first talk about
the different possible energy states. So I said one energy state is where the two neighbors are both spin up. Another energy state is where both neighbors are spin down. Then we have, again, the two unique cases of one up, one down, one down, one up. Again, that would be the same in energy as the original peak to begin with. And because there's twice as many possibilities of it occurring, then that middle signal would be, if not exactly double in height, double in area compared to the two other signals that would be generated. This kind of formation, because it consists now of three sub-peaks, is known as a triplet. Yes?
The spin, this is for the two hydrogen variables.
That's right. These are spins of HB.
So what you're putting is just the possibilities of the combinations of spin directions.
That's right. That's right, because where one spin would add to the magnetic field, the other would subtract again. And so if we did a splitting chart, we'll see the same thing, or what's called a splitting tree. And the way a splitting tree works is much like what we did up above, where you start with one signal, and you say, what will happen if this neighbor interacts with it? But then you can keep on adding additional neighbors and seeing how that would further split the signals that are generated. So in the first case, we started with a signal for A. We said, allow one neighbor to interact with it. That caused the generation of two signals that were separated by a certain distance expressed by this thing called the coupling constant. So again, the top would be no neighbors that are interacting. The next is one neighbor. But then each of those would be split by the second neighbor because its spin is independent of the first one. So each of these two signals that I've just drawn, you would need to split further. But because it's the same neighbor that's interacting, the split will have exactly the same coupling constant. As such, the signal on the left, the greater chemical shift, when it gets further split, it will generate one peak that's in the same position that will result when the other signal is split. Again, because they have the same J values, the same extent of splitting is occurring. So that means coincidentally, those energies would line up with each other, exactly what we predicted just on the basis of the spin states themselves. Really, these are the same picture. I've just developed it in two different ways. One is just to look at all the spin possibilities. The other one is to tackle the splitting one proton at a time. But both give you the same results that you'll have overall integration of 1 to 2 to 1. Yes? Because we're saying that we're just arbitrarily assigning the magnetic field of the machine to be pointed in that same direction. So notice the pattern that's developed here. With one neighbor, we got a split into two peaks. With two neighbors, we got a split into three peaks. Well, would you imagine would happen if we had a methyl group? Well, if you had three neighbors, that's a methyl group, you might think that we should get four peaks. And that is exactly what happens. Because if you have three spins, you've got three independent spins, you've got four unique energy possibilities. All of them up, two of them up, one of them up, none of them up. Well, but those aren't all the possibilities, period, because you can have different spins up or down. So in fact, you can have the spins up, 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 down, up, down, up, up, down, 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 up, up, down, up, down, 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 up, and down, down, down. 8 unique possibilities. All I did right then was say the numbers 0 through 7 in binary, which is another way of thinking about the different possible spin states. Do you need to be able to regurgitate all those different spin states your own cells? Of course. Why else would I be spending all this time talking about it? Because we're developing simple splitting trees at the moment where we're only worried about one type of neighbor. But what we're going to come up against next quarter is the situation where you'll have 3 different neighbors. They'll each have 3 different coupling constants. And so you won't have the different spin states aligning on top of each other nearly so cleanly as we have in this case. So we're tackling these simple cases first because we need to use the same technique to analyze more difficult situations in the future. Let's go ahead and see this splitting tree and see how these 8 different energy states would align. So the example molecule would be what now in which we have a methyl group. We'll still have the same HA on a carbon with just 2 chlorines attached. There are the 8 different energy states, but some of them are degenerate, which means equal in energy. So the 8 possibilities were up, up, up. Up, up, down. Up, down, up. Up, down, down. Down, up, up. Down, up, down. Down, down, up. And down, down, down. Notice we've regenerated those 4 unique types of energy that I've mentioned, all up, 2 up, 1 up, none up. And notice that 2 of those energy states have degeneracies. The second and the third, there are 3 of that same energy, statistically, which means the peaks generated will be 3 times the height of the ones on the outside. And so you would see represented on the spectrum something like this. And with relative heights of 1, 3, 3, and 1. We could do what we did just previously and draw a splitting tree. Each time we split, we're still being split by the same HB, the same neighbor. And so that's why these energy states are going to coalesce and overlap on top of each other. Because we'll start out with just the one peak where we had no neighbors. We'll have the first split that makes a doublet. When that doublet splits, you make a triplet. And when that triplet splits, you'll make the quartet. Don't know if I said this out loud yet. This is known as a quartet, because you have 4 peaks within that subgroup. Now, there is a generalized rule that let me come to that in just a moment. First, let's go back and look at this pattern. Notice that the first case we had peak intensities of 1, 1. The second case, the triplet, we had peak intensities of 1, 2, 1. The quartet, 1, 3, 3, 1. If somehow we could end up with 4 neighbors, which we couldn't have that on any one individual carbon, because if we had 4 hydrogens on a carbon, that's the molecule methane, which doesn't have any neighbors. But what if you had 2 neighbors on one side, 2 neighbors on the other, and the 4 of them were chemically equivalent to each other? We could imagine a situation, a molecule like this. Those 4 hydrogens that I've indicated again, ignoring stereochemistry, would all be equivalent to each other. So if you had four neighbors, you might guess that you'd end up making a quintet, a set of five peaks. What do you predict the heights of those peaks would be? 1, 4, 6, 4, 1, and how did you get that? What is this really that we're developing here? Pascal's triangle, which if you don't remember what Pascal's triangle is, you might have ended up discussing that back in your math classes when discussing polynomial expansion. Because if you had x plus y, for example, raised to the first power, that is 1x plus 1y. If you have x plus y squared, that's 1x squared plus 2xy plus 1y squared. If you have x plus y cubed, that's 1x cubed plus 3x squared y plus 3xy squared plus 1y cubed. If you just let x equal spin up and y be spin down, then the patterns generated by Pascal's triangle, patterns generated by polynomial expansion, are exactly the same as the patterns generated by splitting. It's just one of those interesting mathematical coincidences. Yes?
So the first step that you reach that arrow, all those hydrogens are symmetric
stuff.
But the hydrogens, they're not all different, though. So
where
do you
think
this Pascal's
triangle concept? This molecule, I was saying out loud that if we first saw a doublet, a triplet, a quartet, and they were corresponding to 1, 2, and 3 neighbors. What if I was looking at the hydrogen in the middle of this molecule that has 4 equivalent neighbors, ignoring what happens with the methyl group up top, which that's what our discussion next quarter will get into. But by having those 4 neighbors, we're going to end up with a quintet. If you don't remember Pascal's triangle, the way that you generate each succeeding row of the triangle is to look up above, and where you have the two numbers, add them together and put the new result between the two numbers. And notice that's exactly what's effectively happening when we have splitting, where the coupling constant is the same for each interaction. 1 plus 2 end up making 3. Then in the case of generating Pascal's triangle itself, we add 1s to either side of the rows after we've done all these different additions. Now, I'm not going to ask you what Pascal's triangle is in the lab quiz. It's just where I can make these kind of unexpected connections I like to. Yes?
The hydrogen that you're talking about, also see the neighbors above it?
Right, and that's what I'm saying, ignoring for the moment, because I don't want to get into splitting of splitting yet. One degree of difficulty at a time. So, let me summarize these effects then in what's called the n plus 1 rule. That when observing a proton, with n equivalent neighbors, a multiplet, that's the generalized word to express all these different spin possibilities. So a multiplet with n plus 1 peaks will be generated. Now, let me briefly show you how this information's eventually going to be used. Uh-oh. Well, there we go. Oh, it's already on the board there. Oh, but ignore the answer that's down below there. And let's just look at the spectrum. Now, in real life, when you get a problem like this, you probably won't be given a spectrum. I'll probably give you the information that you can get derived from the spectrum, only because from where you're sitting, even on something like this, it's hard to make out how many lines there are there. So I don't want to make the act of even trying to read the spectrum part of the problem that you'll get. You'll just be given the information. Well, what information do we have from this? Well, we see that there's a group of signals that seems to be centered at chemical shift of 1.5, and there's a group of signals that's centered at chemical shift roughly 3.2. So you'd be given two listings, delta, that's the symbol for chemical shift, delta 1.5, delta 3.2. Next to each of those numbers would be listed the integrations. And I'll just tell you that for the peak on the left, the integration is 2, and the peak on the right, the integration is 3. You'd then also be given the splitting information. Now, from where you're sitting, hopefully you can see this well enough. Then can you tell me what kind of signal I have for this left-hand peak? It looks kind of like a quartet. It's not perfect, but that may just be due to the phasing of whoever originally took the spectrum. With a more careful experiment, you might be able to get where it's perfectly one-third the height for each of these shorter peaks compared to the taller peaks. So we have an absorbance at 3.2 with an integration of 2 split into a quartet. Then we have a peak at 1.5 that has an integration of 3 split into what appears to be a triplet, because you have 1, 2, 3 peaks, and very roughly, the heights appear to be 1, 2, 1. Now again, the heights themselves don't technically have to be exactly 1, 2, 1. The areas under those curves have to be 1, 2, 1. Well, that's what we're going to get into, because what if I tell you that this chemical formula is C2H5Br? Well, actually, with just that piece of information, you could instantly figure out the chemical formula, because there's only one formula possible from C2H5Br. So let me, in fact, scroll down and show it to you. It's bromoethane. But how does this spectrum match the fact this is bromoethane? Well, I told you earlier that the peak on the left integrated to 2 and the peak on the right integrated to 3. Well, the peak on the left is further downfield, which would seem to mean that it's closer to the bromine. We have the bromine that is next to only 2 hydrogens as its immediate neighbor. That would match with the fact that this peak has an integration of 2. If we look at the carbon that's further away, the methyl group, it should have a lower chemical shift because it's further away from the bromine, which it does. And that's the peak that I indicated had an integration of 3. As far as splitting, the methylene, remember that's our common name for a CH2 group, the methylene next to the bromine has 3 neighbors, which means it should be split into a quartet. Well, that's again exactly what we see. Then the methyl group has 2 neighbors, which should split it into a triplet. Yet again, that's exactly what we've seen. So in the future, this is the way that we'll put a molecule together. For example, whenever we see a quartet, our first instinct will be to say, oh, that means there's a methyl group right next door. If you can demonstrate that, you've found the end of a molecule. And from there, you can rationalize your way into creating the rest of the structure of that molecule by comparing how many hydrogens are located at that position, how many hydrogens are located next to that position. Because integration will tell you how many hydrogens you have in one place, and splitting will tell you how many hydrogens you have next door. If you tried to conceptualize that, imagine you had tiles, where one number in the tile is how many hydrogens there are, the next number is how many is next to it, and then you assemble all that conceptually together. You make the structure of the molecule. And so that's going to be our activity next quarter, that you'll be given a series of increasingly more complicated spectra, and you'll be expected to determine from that the structure of a compound. Yes?
You said for the triplet, ratio 1 to 2 to 1.
Should be roughly present in the heights. I say roughly, though, because it's not height that technically has to be exactly 1 to 1. It is the area under the curve. You would have to know by observation that that is a quartet, that is a triplet. Once you've established that, then that means you have 3 neighbors and 2 neighbors respectively. Questions? Can I scroll it down? Of course. going to get into all those different possibilities. So we're going to talk about alkanes, ring compounds, benzene-containing compounds, alcohols, ethers, all the different functional groups as we get to them, except this quarter. We're going to talk about analyzing spectra. This quarter, we're barely going to make it through all the theory. Like, we've had our first presentation of splitting. We'll actually get another presentation of splitting, but we won't have the chance to solve spectra this quarter. Next quarter, then, is where we really get to work with NMR. All right, we are a little bit overdue for our short break, so we'll take a 5-minute break. Then I have one more topic related to NMR that I need to discuss, and then we need to go over gas chromatography. So let's take our break, and I'll be back. This last topic is not, again, directly related to NMR, but it is a piece of information that you're going to use when trying to determine the structure of a compound. Because in a full problem, I'll give you an NMR spectrum. I might even give you an IR spectrum, because it's often easier, quicker to determine certain functional groups' presence through IR instead of NMR. And any bit of hint that we get about the structure helps it. It makes a structure elucidation even easier. So, besides those two things, I'll almost always give you a chemical formula as well. And from the chemical formula itself, we can get some structural information because there's something known as the degree of unsaturation. Now, I know that term, unsaturation, has come up earlier in the quarter when we were talking about compounds having only single bonds versus double or triple bonds. Technically, though, even compounds with just single bonds might not be fully saturated. We're following a rigorous definition of what unsaturation is. So saturated refers to a compound that has the maximum number of hydrogens possible given the number of carbons present. And I'll just state that, aside from other factors that we'll discuss in just a moment, that the number of hydrogens that could be present is equal to 2C plus 2. And let's see a simple example that we could use to rationalize this formula. And that simple example would be something like hexane. Hexane has 2 methyl groups and 4 methylene groups. Each of those middle methylene groups has 2 hydrogens each. And so that's where the 2C portion of this formula comes from. Because even on the methyl groups, we of course have 2 hydrogens. But on each methyl group, we also have a 3rd hydrogen. In a straight chain molecule like this, we only have 2 ends. So 2 extra hydrogens, that's the source of the plus 2. In the equation. So 2C plus 2. Even if we didn't have a straight chain compound, even if we had something that had branches in it, we're still going to find the formula will apply. So let's say we had something like isopentane. We could look at it and say, well, there are 3 methyl groups, so 3 times 3 hydrogens. There's a tertiary carbon that has 1 hydrogen, there's a secondary carbon that has 2 hydrogens, and all together that would be 12 hydrogens. Well, if C is equal to 5, 2C plus 2 is equal to 12. And so that matches our prediction. But what would happen if we tried to make a cyclic compound? if we had something like cyclohexane? Well, cyclohexane only has the formula C6H12.
Even though it's 2 times 6 plus 2, that should give us 14 if we have 6 carbons. But we have 2 less because in order to make the ring, we would have effectively had to have removed a hydrogen from either end of plain old hexane so that a new carbon-carbon bond could form. And in fact, every time that we make some extra connection, whether it be to form a ring like this, or whether it is to make a double bond like hexene, both of those, in fact, have the same chemical formula with 6 carbons. Because in both cases, we would have had to pull off a pair of hydrogens to make either the closure of the ring or this double bond. So one pair of hydrogens removed, that's referred to as a degree of unsaturation. And both a ring and an alkene, the presence, or not even an alkene, any kind of double bond, those would each count for 1 degree of unsaturation. And again, by degree of unsaturation, we mean effectively 2 hydrogens are missing. Now, the only other structural feature that will cause unsaturation is a triple bond. So if we had something like pentyne, that has 5 carbons, but only 8 hydrogens. Now, C5... that should give us 2 times 5 plus 2, which is 12 hydrogens. We only have 8. So 2 pairs of hydrogens are missing, each one corresponding to one of the pi bonds that's now present. So triple bonds end up counting as 2 degrees of unsaturation. And again, I'll write underneath here that that corresponds effectively to 4 hydrogens being missing. So we could come up with a generalized formula for degree of unsaturation, because since the number of degrees of unsaturation depends on the pairs, number of pairs of hydrogens missing, we compare how many hydrogens we expect to have, subtract out how many hydrogens we really do have, and divide that number by 2. So, our initial formula for degree of unsaturation will be number of hydrogens based on the number of carbons minus number of hydrogens present and that whole thing divided by 2. I say our initial version of this formula because we do have to take a couple of things into consideration. So far we've only seen hydrocarbons, but what if we had an oxygen or halogen or nitrogen, very common atoms found on organic compounds? Let's see how those different types of atoms have or don't have an effect on how many hydrogens we think should be present. Now I'm going to divide this up into 3 cases. The 3 cases that we'll normally encounter in regular organic compounds. I'm going to use ethane as my comparison compound, and I'm only going to write out formally the hydrogens on one of the 2 carbons of ethane.
My first comparison is going to be between ethane and ethanol, where we've added an oxygen. Notice, though, that that oxygen doesn't seem to have had any effect on the number of hydrogens that would need to be present in order to generate a structure that doesn't have charge and has the correct number of connections to oxygen. Oxygen, in other words, likes being divalent, which means it can just be slipped in between a carbon-hydrogen bond. So chalcogens, such as oxygen and sulfur, have no effect on the hydrogen count because they're divalent. Another case then would be to compare ethane and ethaneamine, where we have a nitrogen present. Notice that in order for the amine to be neutral, there is one additional hydrogen. And that's because pnictogens, like nitrogen, prefer to be trivalent. So, nitrogen and phosphorus add to the hydrogen count. Or if I'm talking about nitrogen, it adds to the hydrogen count because it is trivalent. That's nitrogen being left of oxygen on the periodic table. Well, if we go to the right and look at halogens, well, we end up with the opposite situation. Although halogens are able to form polyvalent compounds, just think of the ion iodate, for example. Iodine having connection to three oxygens. In organic compounds, the far more common case is for a halogen to be monovalent, meaning only having one connection. If that's true, then if it's going to take a position on a carbon-based molecule, you have to get rid of a hydrogen wherever that halogen would be substituted. And so effectively, we are missing one hydrogen. So halogens effectively subtract from the halogen or the hydrogen count. And that's since they are normally monovalent. So if we wanted to take these considerations and incorporate that into our original formula, we can come up with the overall degree of unsaturation formula, which is that you still start with that base number of 2C plus 2. You then add one for each nitrogen, phosphorus, or other pnictogen. You then subtract for each halogen. Oxygen, the other chalcogens we saw, don't affect the hydrogen count, so we don't even need to mention them into this formula. This, so far, would be the adjusted number of hydrogens that should be on a fully saturated compound. We're then still going to compare that to how many hydrogens are really present, so we'll subtract that number of hydrogens, and then the whole darn thing, we divide by 2. Now, why is this at all useful? Well, let's say that we have one of these problems, like what I will give you in the future, where you have both IR and NMR available. Let's say that you have a chemical formula that you're given also that indicates you have only 1 degree of unsaturation. Let's say in your IR, you see a carbonyl, a carbon-oxygen double bond, because those are very readily apparent by IR. Well, carbon-oxygen double bond, that is the degree of unsaturation itself. And so if you see in your IR spectroscopy that there's a carbonyl, you know there are no carbon-carbon double bonds. You also know that if, since you've already accounted for the 1 degree of unsaturation, there would be no rings on that compound. And sometimes just those little pieces of information can be enough that allows you to much more easily determine the structure of a compound from an MR spectrum. So questions about degree of unsaturation. All right. Oh, yes. Actually, you can, in some circumstances, still determine the formula without, or still determine the structure without a formula. But if you think of those two different ethers I showed you earlier, again, that would be a situation where you would need to have a formula or some other quantitative information. So sometimes you can do it without, but there are cases where you do need it. Yes? Nitrogen, because each nitrogen only requires one additional hydrogen. Because imagine that you're sticking a nitrogen in between a carbon-hydrogen bond. Then one connection from the nitrogen would be to the carbon, a second connection would be to the hydrogen that's already there, and then you need one more hydrogen to make that third connection, but only one more. All right, so let's now move to gas chromatography. So again, if you're keeping separate NMR notes, you should switch over to a different set of notes. Gas chromatography is, in fact, the first form of chromatography that we discussed at all when we discussed chromatography. So let me show you a very simplified diagram of what physically a gas chromatograph looks like. It's usually got four components to it, four major components. This is gas chromatography, and as we're going to discuss momentarily, that means that the mobile phase is a gas itself. If we're analyzing samples in the gas phase, but most of our organic samples are going to be solids, or for GC, we usually start with something that's liquid, we have to vaporize that sample. And so the first step in a GC chromatography experiment is generally to inject a very tiny portion of that sample into a heated injection port. That sample then passes into what is referred to as a column. Now, of course, the word column would indicate some tall cylindrical object. But if we imagine that we took a cylinder and just continued to stretch it and stretch it and stretch it and make something that loops around it, that still by extension is referred to in chromatography as a column. That column is generally placed inside an oven so that the sample can be maintained in the gas phase as it passes through the column. Once it gets through the column, it will then hit some form of detector, which yet again is usually heated to maintain everything in the gas phase until the sample's completely out of the machine. Now this column, in turn, is usually like the following, where the outside of that column is metal, usually some stainless steel or something else that's likely to be unreactive. That's to provide physical support to the column, since this is something that's going to get heated. On the inside of that column is the stationary phase, the separatory material that can distinguish or separate different kinds of compounds. Your sample is going to pass through the column by the action of what's known as a carrier gas. So there's one more thing in this system, the carrier gas itself. The carrier gas would be much like the solvent in a TLC experiment. So in a TLC experiment, we spotted compounds on a plate. Those compounds did move, just like the compounds will move in this GC. But something moved those compounds in TLC, which was the development solvent. Similarly, something will move the compounds in GC, and that is the carrier gas. So carrier gas is floating through. At the same time, therefore, the sample is floating through. Based on what kind of sample you're trying to analyze, you might actually have different temperatures at your injection port, your oven, and your detector. On even fancier chromatography devices, you might have temperature profiles or temperature programs, where maybe you start everything off at a lower temperature to encourage only the lighter molecular weight, lower boiling point materials to come through quickly. But then if you have larger, more, to sort of anthropomorphize it, recalcitrant compounds, you could heat the whole device up to cause those compounds to come through more quickly. So let me write down a little description of what happens in a GC experiment. So in gas chromatography, a liquid sample is injected into a port. Which is heated so that the sample can be vaporized or volatilized upon injection. The sample is then passed through a column. That is also heated. So as to maintain the samples in the gas phase. A carrier gas, which is generally some form of inert gas, which usually means nitrogen, helium, or argon, is used to help push the sample through the column. So let me just note here on what I'm writing. The sample is passed through a column. That is the stationary phase. And then a carrier gas, which would qualify then as the mobile phase. And again, it's usually an inert gas such as nitrogen, helium, or argon. That gas is used to help push the sample through the column. Now, the behavior of gases is obviously different than that of liquids. And so there's going to be two major effects on why would compounds separate from each other as they pass through this column. One of the reasons is polarity, exactly the same reason that we had separation occur in TLC. So if you imagine that we have a very polar coating on the inside of this column, and we pass a polar compound through it, well, the compound will interact heavily with that column and won't make it through as quickly to the end of the machine. Same scenario, polar coating, a nonpolar compound passes through. It won't have much interaction with that coating, and so it'll be more easily pushed through by the carrier gas. And so there's going to be a time factor that's involved. But besides just plain polarity, there is the fact that different mass molecules have a different average velocity to them, even at the same temperature. And so there's some influence of the size of the molecule or the boiling point on the molecule on how rapidly it will pass through the machine. So on the basis of polarity, and I'll simplify by expressing it as boiling point, the compounds will be separated as they pass through the column. So again, as the sample, passes through the column, the components of the sample are separated based mainly on the basis of polarity and boiling point. As the compounds successfully pass completely through the column, the quantity of a compound that's exiting the machine at any one time is measured by a detector. Now, there are different kinds of detectors that can be used for different sorts of circumstances. The type of detector that we have is effectively a flame ionization detector. And to try to simplify how that works, imagine that you have a really hot, thin piece of wire, a filament it's called. And imagine that we pass a current through that wire. Well, if that wire is particularly thin and of the right material, its conductivity can be influenced by different compounds that pass over that wire. And so as these different gas samples come through the column and come across the detector, that change in conductivity corresponds to the quantity of compound that comes through. There are also spectroscopic detectors. So you might have a general broad UV detector that, again, could also be used to determine the quantity of compound that comes through. Exactly which detector you use depends on your application, which getting into the various applications is beyond the level of this course. So all you really need to worry about is what do the results look like, which is the following. The graph generated which I say graph but not spectrum, because you're not passing different frequencies of light through this. You're really just measuring how long does it take for a compound to come through. In fact, that is the x-axis, the retention time. And that retention time is, again, the time it takes for a compound to pass from the injection port to the detector. The graph may look something like this. For a well-established system, you can determine, or if you have a set of reference compounds, you can determine what the retention time should be for the various individual components. And then much like the fact that in TLC, if you have a reproducible protocol, RF values can be used to identify compounds. In the same way, if you have a well-established protocol for a gas chromatography machine, retention time is used to determine the identity of compounds. Since in most applications, the response by the detector is linearly proportional to how much of a compound is passing through it at any one point, then we can use the integral, the area on these curves, to determine the relative quantity of each of the components present. Which, if you know the initial volume of your sample, you can figure out the volume of the products coming off, and therefore analyze the composition of a mixture. So let's see, retention time is used to determine identity. The quantity of a compound present is determined by the area of the peak observed. So what we will do, and actually, we may end up at this point doing it as a class. When we do the GC analysis, we'll take the mixture of alkenes that we developed, pass that through, and we'll compare that to values of the alkenes that we do have individual samples for that we can also pass through on a calibration run. I say that we may end up doing that as a class instead, because we are short the one day due to the power outage, and the fact that using the GC is not in itself really a useful activity in a sense, because all you would do is to inject the sample and push a button, and then there's nothing else, no other interaction that you have with that machine. So in fact, what's really more important is that you understand the theory behind it. And so even if we did do it as a group activity, you should be able to look at that chart, given the reference compounds, and identify the different alkenes that would be present. So we will do that on Thursday. What are we going to be doing for today? Well, if you did do your prelabs, so I didn't, yet again, did not mention the prelabs for experiment 7. But we actually have a bit more time left in lab than the other two sections had, because you already had the discussion about NMR solvents, where they needed to have that discussion. And We were also a little bit behind in other aspects in lecture in those sections. So we have about 45 minutes left. If you have already done your pre-lab, if you would like to go ahead and mix your components together to begin experiment number 7, you may go ahead and do so. We will use the regular quantities as stated in the text. And the carborundum boiling stone that's mentioned in that procedure, those are the black sort of lava rock looking stones that are in one of the bottles that's over there on the refrigerator. So you probably won't have time, I guess, to do... Well, let me think. How long did it say to heat the samples? I forget without looking at the procedure. 5 minutes. So not actually terribly long, is it? So you might not get through isolating your product today, but we're going to have 2 more lab periods after this in which you would be able to get your IR done for the product that is formed. Now, on the syllabus, it does say that we're supposed to be doing UV analysis, but really that was really incorrectly scheduled because UV is a topic that really is supposed to be in the Chem 12B program because we get it at the same time that we get conjugated dienes. So we will instead do UV vis the next quarter where it more appropriately belongs. But by cutting that out, that will give us the time to complete the IR for this new lab that we're about to begin. Of course, a few of you still have the solid IRs from the previous experiment, the formation of the dibromo product. So how many of you, in fact, do still need to do that solid IR? Okay, a few of you. And then, of course, we still have NMR that we need to make our way through. How many of you still have an NMR scan that you need to do of the reference compound? Don't worry about your own samples yet. Just how many left on the reference compound. Okay. So you have 3 possible activities for today. Work on your solid IR, work on the NMR, work on your last synthesis of the quarter. We'll go over the theory behind that synthesis next lab lecture, just so I don't use up any more time from today. But are there any questions about what you need to be doing then? Yes? For the solid, the dibromo product, if you needed to check out a beaker or something just to temporarily keep it in while you begin your next experiment, that'd be fine. So since we will be having people that begin the new experiment, if you are, quote unquote, just waiting for the NMR, you do need to go ahead and have your goggles on. And I guess that's it. So let's go ahead and get to work then.